My mother, and I love her very much, is one of these women who can only relate to the world through self-effacement. Maybe you know the type. She serves a wonderful Sunday dinner, and when complimented on it, she'll say something like, "Oh, I don't know. I always serve peas with this meal. I don't know why I serve beans with this time. Peas would have been much better, don't you think? Why do I serve peas?" Well, one of the things that she regrets is that she passed up the opportunity to name me William Stark Stinson. Why William Stark? William Stark is a name that is given to the firstborn male of every generation in my family. Why didn't I name you William Stark? I'm sure you would have appreciated that much more than your cousin. Well, why William Stark? Well, every New Hampshire school child learns the story about how in 1752, John Stark, his brother William, and William's brother-in-law, David Stinson, were out hunting in the wilds of northern New Hampshire near what is now Rumney, New Hampshire. On the morning of April 28th, John Stark was out checking on the trap lines when he was captured by Indians. The Indians then used him as bait to try to draw William and David into a trap. And the plan was working perfectly. David and William were in a canoe. They're paddling towards the shore where John Stark is there waving. The Indians are behind with their rifles poised. And then at the last minute, just before the Indians fired, John Stark broke free, knocked the guns into the air, saving his brother's life. But not, alas, Stinson's. So some of you may be wondering how this event could result in a family name handed down through the generations, much less a story told or taught to every school child in the state of New Hampshire. So raise your hand. How many people know who John Stark is? One. Heard the story many times. General John Stark, hero of the Battle of Bennington? Any ring a bell, anybody? No? Okay. Well, let me take another tack here. How many of you know the New Hampshire state motto? It's on all the license plates. When those of you raise your hand, can you say it out loud?
Live free or die.
Right. Live free or die. Well, live free or die was said by none other than John Stark. Now, David Stinson did get a brook, a lake, and a mountain named after him. And I'm proud to say I share my surname with a mountain memorialized by my relative, the one famed for not being saved by John Stark, famous Revolutionary War hero. Fortunately for me, there were other Stinsons around at the time, and one John Stark became a local and state leader, one of New Hampshire's first supporters of Thomas Jefferson, and, according to the history of the town of Dunbarton, a strenuous advocate of religious freedom. Now, this brings up a good point. The light of our founding fathers, Franklin, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, shines so brightly that oftentimes we fail to take notice of the fact that they could not have accomplished what they did without the support of thousands of people in the small towns and villages and wilderness settlements throughout the 13 colonies. People like John Stinson. Now, how can we find out more about what these lesser whites thought? Well, one way is to go and look at state constitutions. And by reading state constitutions, we can get a sense of what these people were thinking about on a variety of topics, including religious freedom. Now, New Hampshire has the distinction of adopting an interim constitution on January 5th, 1776. Making it the first state to declare independence from Great Britain. The people of the state of New Hampshire then argued for another 7 years, mostly about how to form a government without giving it any actual power, before finally settling on a final constitution. Now, you may think 7 years is a long time, but keep in mind that the Bill of Rights wasn't adopted for another 8 years after that. Now, the New Hampshire Constitution has some remarkable statements in it. Take, for example, Article 10. Article 10 states that if the government becomes tyrannical, the people of the state have not just the right, but the duty to take up arms and overthrow the government. It says right there, it's the Article Right of Revolution. Challenge the Berkeley City Council to come up with anything better than that. Now, of more interest are the first three articles of the Constitution. They declare that people have certain, are born free and independent, and they have certain inherent rights. Now, these rights are not privileges granted by the monarch. They're not rights granted by the Constitution. They are intrinsic rights that we all have simply by being human beings. It also states that people can may voluntarily surrender some of these rights to society in return for society's protection of other rights. Now, this is the concept known as the social contract, probably most famously put forward by John Locke. Very well established. But the epiphany comes in the next article, Article 4. Now, Article 4 asserts that some rights cannot be surrendered to society because there is nothing that society can give in return of equal value. The one right that's listed specifically in Article 4 is the right of conscience. Now, think about that for a moment. The framers of this Constitution are sitting there that there is nothing you can be given that's as valuable as your right to develop and hold personal beliefs about what is right and what is wrong. Nothing is as important as the freedom to pursue in your own way the answers to the ultimate questions of life and meaning. Not food, not shelter, not life itself. Nothing. This is the meaning of live free or die. It is so difficult to understand what life was like back then, looking as we do through the modern lens of modern culture. Imagine, we start a society believing it was a fact as obvious as the sun rises in the east, that God intended us to have our betters tell us what is right and what is wrong, and how we should think about religion. It was an accepted fact that the way to promote religion was to put the might of the state behind it. And a few short years later, we believe that it was an individual's right to approach God as he saw fit, that this right to approach God was sacred, and that this is the one place where the state shall not tread, and that true religion would flourish as a result. This is the great American experiment. Not democracy, that had been tried before, but the United States may be the first society to be built on the principle of religious freedom. Now, how did this come about? We tell our children that the colonists came to the New World seeking religious freedom. Nothing could be further from the truth. They may have come here to escape religious persecution, that's true, but religious freedom was not on their minds. In fact, before Booth hit Beach, theocracy was established. The Puritans were the most notorious of these. Only members of their church were allowed to vote. And who gets to decide who belongs to the church? Well, the church elders. It's a very controlled situation there. Not only that, but they were extremely intolerant of other religions. Catholics were driven from Massachusetts with a whip to their back. Quakers were hung by the neck in the trees of Boston Common. But the Puritans were not unique. Every colony had an established religion in one form or another. Churches were supported by tax dollars. Dissenters experienced discrimination, if not outright persecution. The Pope was the Antichrist. Now, what caused that change? Well, one factor was the religious fervor known as the Great Awakening. This resulted in the creation of many new denominations. Witnessing abuse meted out to the members of these denominations began to disgust a growing number of people, James Madison among them. Some of these sects saw Jesus' teachings that my kingdom is not of this world, and render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, as a biblical injunction against the mingling of church and state. As a result, the Baptists and forerunners of today's evangelical Christians were among the most fervent supporters of the strictest separation between church and state. Some factors were purely practical. The Continental Congress discovered it had almost as many religions represented as there were delegates. They could either hang together or hang separately. Washington, fearing invasion from the north, sought to minimize British support there. Consequently, he vigorously and successfully fought to quell anti-Catholic sentiments to the United States. Needing a truly national force, he rigorously enforced religious tolerance within the army. For Madison, the radical idea of religious tolerance missed the mark. He believed that true faith must flow from a free mind. Holding to a different faith was not a privilege to be tolerated by a monarch or even by an invited majority. It was an intrinsic right. When the phrase religious tolerance crossed his desk, he'd slash it out and write in freedom. If this freedom is abused, he wrote, it's an offense against God, not against man. Both Jefferson and Madison looked at the history of the church and concluded Christianity was most vibrant in its early years, but became more abundant and corrupt once it became a state religion by Constantine. They convincingly argued that truth and good eventually win in a free marketplace of ideas, and government power only props up falsehood and weakness. Religious freedom was precious to these men, because, in part, they were on their own religious journeys. Washington credited the intervention of God with his victories and blamed moral weakness for his defeats. He forbade swearing in the Continental Army. Yet he never took communion. During his presidency, his minister gave a sermon with a thinly veiled rebuke of this practice. Washington stopped going to church on Communion Sunday. In his youth, Franklin thought that it was beneath the dignity of God to meddle in the affairs of men, and concluded that God must have created deputy gods to look after each of the many planets that must exist throughout the universe. Jefferson believed that clergy purposefully obfuscated religious teaching and struck alliances with tyrants in order to protect their own privileges. He called Jesus the greatest moral teacher the world has ever seen or ever would see, but denied his divinity. Jefferson assembled his own Bible, cutting the words of Jesus from several translations of the Bible and pasting them into a notebook. He was convinced that if it were not for the corruptions introduced by priests, starting with Paul, all the world would have long ago accepted Jesus' teachings. It is interesting to note that the New Testament used by the other major branch of Swedenborgianism, the General Church, contains only Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Revelations, excluding all the writings of Paul. Jefferson's library contained at least two volumes of Swedenborg's works, including Apocalypse Revealed. He invited John Hargrove, the first Swedenborgian minister ordained in the United States, to give public lectures in the halls of Congress on at least two occasions. Adams, while a Unitarian, had a hard time shaking his Puritan roots. Throughout his presidency, he believed government support of religion was necessary, although such aid should be distributed without favoring one sect over the other. He frequently enlisted almighty aid in the battles of his administration. This resulted in a bitter struggle between Adams and Jefferson, with Adams' operatives calling Jefferson an infidel and declaring that a vote for Jefferson is a vote against God. However, this backfired, and Adams later wrote that his position, quote, alarmed and alienated Quakers, Anabaptists, Mennonists, Moravians, Swedenborgians, Methodists, Catholics, Episcopalians, Arians, Socinians, Arminians, etc., 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 atheists and deists. The Founding Fathers used their religious freedom to study, contemplate, debate, and most significantly, to change. Adams, perhaps, changed the most. In his 80s, Adams worked to remove state support of religion from the Massachusetts state constitution. He studied all the world's religions and wrote, quote, "Men ought, after they have examined with unbiased judgments every system of religion and chosen one system on their own authority for themselves, to avow their opinions and defend them with boldness." The Founding Fathers confirmed, as we would say in Swedenborgian terms, that each individual is a church specific, pursuing a path of spiritual growth. Interesting, the Founding Fathers also converged on a definition of the church universal, which echoes our reading today of Matthew 22. Jefferson succinctly laid out this common creed in 1822 when he wrote, "That to love God with all thy heart and thy neighbor as thyself is the sum of religion." They saw that the one path to enlightenment was the freedom to pursue many paths, and that these many paths, one path, led to a single mountaintop expressible in three words: love thy neighbor. During the Revolutionary War, exhortations that God is on our side were routinely used to rally the troops. There was a common belief that to enlist in the Continental Army was to enlist in Christ's army. Many thought God had singled out the nation for a special role in history, and with some reason. Washington was famous for making numerous military blunders, putting himself in harm's way many times, and yet escaping unharmed. He once observed in amazement, "By the all-powerful dispensations of providence, I have been protected beyond all human probability or expectation." Now, their early jingoistic rhetoric may be a reflection of the irrationality of a ragtag collection of colonies challenging one of the world's great and rising powers. In later years, the Founding Fathers repudiated their belief that the United States held a special place in God's eye. Adams wrote in 1812, "There is no special providence for us. We are not a chosen people that I know of." Now, while denouncing chauvinism, I believe there is an essential truth hidden in their early belief that God had a special role for this nation. In one of his visions, Emanuel Swedenborg saw a crystal-walled church building that represented the New Jerusalem, or the New Church, as prophesied in Revelation. A church made possible by the understanding of the word he was bringing to the world. Above the door was the Latin phrase, "Nunc licet," which he knew to mean, "Now it is permitted to enter with understanding into the mysteries of faith." This is the quote that we find on the wall in the fireside room of the parish house here. "Nunc licet" is the quintessential Swedenborg soundbite. It expresses the knowledge that we now have the tools to safely dispense with the prejudice, dogmatism, and brutality of blind belief, and to study, question, and reason our way to true faith. But knowledge isn't sufficient. Knowledge must direct will to give form and substance in the natural world to this revelation. Swedenborg needed a Jefferson to take the celestial, "It is permitted," and transform it into the words now carved in white Georgian marble of the Jefferson Memorial: "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man." This then is the miracle of the American experiment. Because they had to struggle through inauspicious beginnings, full of bigotry, dogmatism, hate, and fear, a society was created dedicated to nurturing each and every person on their spiritual journey. The fledgling American nation demonstrated to the world that against all belief, the best way to support those journeys to encourage religion to flourish is to accept that God meant it when he gave us free will, and that no earthly power should attempt to thwart it in matters of conscience. In this way, the United States became part of the cycle of repentance, reformation, and regeneration, creating the new church. For, according to Swedenborg, the second coming of Christ is not so much an event as it is a journey. The founding fathers and thousands of others like them throughout the 13 states carried us forward a giant stride. But as they well understood, they did not complete the task. It is the task that we today inherit. It is the task we should face with humility from the recognition that regeneration is a gift from God, but also with enthusiasm and joy from the beauty and the majesty of what we are created. Once bitter enemies, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson became in old age good friends. Through correspondence, they explored many issues, in particular, the blessings of religious freedom. They firmly believed their friendship would continue into the next life. In a letter to Adams on September 4, 1823, Jefferson painted an image of the two of them standing at the windows of heaven. "You and I shall look down from another world on these glorious achievements to man, which will add to the joys even of heaven." 3 years later, on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, July 4, 1826, both men entered that blissful state. Thank you.